So I'm gonna give you a background about federal crop insurance. I'm gonna talk a little bit about climate and issues around that, and then some of the challenges to changing these things. I'm from the National Center of Appropriate Technology. It has a very long, interesting history. I can tell you the stories about that. But we work in three basic areas. We've been going since 1976, which is pretty good for a nonprofit to be in existence. And we're located in Butte, Montana, and I welcome everyone to come to Butte, Montana. It will be a unique experience of your lifetime to have come to Butte, Montana. They say Butte, America. They don't even say Butte, Montana. So they'll give you a flavor. And they have an excellent national folk fest, international folk fest, in the second week in July. We get people from all over the world. It's a very interesting place to visit and come see our little demonstration farm and our solar cells. So we do solar and sustainable broadly and sustainable agriculture. That's the part I work in. We also run under a cooperative agreement with USDA, the program called ATRA. Who has used ATRA or knows of ATRA? One, okay, that's good. Well, now you all know, so when they add, and it stands for Appropriate Technology Transfer for Rural Areas, which most people don't know. So the title is very similar to NCAT, and it has a very similar sit, but it's a cooperative agreement for 36 years. We have run for the federal government. It's separately funded in the Farm Bill as a separate National Sustainable Agriculture Information Service. So I get paid to answer farmers and ranchers' questions. It's the best job in the world. And we have specialists in all areas. You call us, you text us, you do whatever you want. Within 24 hours, we'll give you some kind of response, and if it's a longer response, we'll give you an excellent response to any question you want to ask about agriculture, broadly, sustainable, organic. We do a lot of work in organic as well. Now, the basis of this talk is a book back there, and I'm running out of them, which is surprising because usually no one takes them. But is organic farming risky? And the answer simply is no more risky than non-organic agriculture, which took us 5 years to come up with that answer. You say, that's kind of a lot of money, $750,000 grant, a lot of research, a lot of surveys. But it's a question that you think is a surprising answer, because most people will say that organic farming is more risky than non-organic farming. And we pretty much demonstrated that it's no more risky. They're all risky. Being a farmer is risky. It's also the basis of this is another publication that I work in, and it's about climate and carbon sequestration. We have copies of that. You can get all of these things right off the web now, and they're free. So I don't bring as much paper. I try to save paper. This is every day I travel over the Continental Divide, and that's about, I think, that when I hit the peak on the back way in, I'm at about almost 7,000 feet, 6,800 feet. I live at 5,500 feet. I go up, and I go down into Butte. And I go through a national forest. Well, people don't know that about a third of Montana is national forest. People think it's only cows and wheat, but we actually have a lot of national forest. And I get to go through the Deer Lodge National Forest every day, twice a day, over and back, over and back, over and back. And you can't see it so much here, so I have kind of watched climate disruption, because you see in there, if you look really carefully, a lot of dead trees. It's a pine beetle infestation. Now there's arguments, of course there's always arguments, about whether that's climate related, because there have been beetle infestations historically and they come in patterns and cycles, but this one has been particularly bad. And when you have a national forest that's huge, we're talking millions of acres, that leads, in addition to not having much and suppressing burning, there's some fantastic, amazing wildfires. I was lucky that it didn't hit my house, but I actually sat with a lawn chair and watched the wildfire go near my house. But I get to see beaver, I get to see elk, I get to see deer, and moose along this way every day. So it's a long commute, it's a 40-minute commute, but it's better than in New York City, I think. Anyway, and I get to see the seasons change, but I also get to see the trees die, and it disturbs me. First statement is agriculture is not the major cause of climate disruption. I know that seems like an outlandish statement, but the evidence is fairly clear, I would argue. About 11%, and there's a whole argument about how that estimate occurs, of greenhouse gas emissions derive out of the agricultural sector. It's probably a little higher because they mix some of that transportation in, unfortunately didn't do it quite right, but it's not significant. Now, I'm not saying that 11% of the greenhouse gas emissions in the United States is not consequential in the amount of greenhouse gases that are being emitted. I'm just saying that agriculture is not the major source. And if you look down here, this thing about land use change, actually, because if you include forests, forests are probably the best sequestering of carbon. If we would just keep forest or reforest, that augments the emissions of agriculture alone. Yes?
Do they have an adjusted greenhouse gas emissions proportion to include the industry and transportation involved with agriculture?
Yes. And some of it, well, I'll get to the next slide. So, and some of it is, some of it isn't. Unfortunately, part of the fertilizer industry is not included. It gets put into a different sector. So, like I said, this is probably a bit of an underestimate, but not maybe 12, 13, you know, but not a significant difference if you just jiggle the numbers around. Oop, wrong way. Here's a better, more detailed thing, and probably a little bit more, too much detail, but I want to point out a couple things that are unique about agriculture and climate. We need improvement. I'm not saying that greenhouse gas emissions is a significant cause of climate disruption. Therefore, any ways we can try to address that issue, I think, is to the good. So we can improve in agriculture for sure. And I would argue that, and will argue that organic farming is probably one of the best systems of production to mitigate greenhouse gases that we have going to date. I know that's perhaps controversial to say, but I want to point out that nitrous oxide, N2O, these are the three major greenhouse gases. Carbon dioxide is not the fundamental issue in greenhouse gas emissions in agriculture. It's synthetic fertilizer. Anybody know what the Haber-Bosch process is for making nitrogen fertilizer is? She does. I can tell she's been studying stuff. She knows. She's going to get me. Anyway, and this is kind of like an elephant in the room. I went to the Natural Resources Conservation Soil annual meeting, and I pointed out that nitrous oxide was the single greatest contributor to greenhouse gases in American agriculture, and therefore I made a proposal to say let's reduce by 50% the use of synthetic fertilizer in agriculture in the United States. And I wasn't well received. But if I wanted to mitigate greenhouse gases from agriculture, that would be the way to do it because it's the single greatest cause. Source, yes.
Is part of that due to the nitrous oxide by weight? Because greenhouse gas is measured in tons?
Or... I don't know. I really don't. I'm not sure what you're getting at, but I don't know. I mean, all I know is that it's one of the reasons why it's not accentuated was one, because the fertilizer industry doesn't like to hear it, and two, it's because it's harder to measure and expensive to measure the amount of release of nitrous oxide in its use when you're doing it. I met some people who are doing that research, and it's very expensive research to do. It's much easier to track other greenhouse gases than it is to track nitrous oxide, but just in the manufacturing alone. And by the way, the European Union, in their equivalent of a farm bill, has set a goal to reduce 50% use of synthetic fertilizer in Europe. And the farmers aren't happy about it either. So we'll see. But they actually have set that as a goal because they know if agriculture is going to contribute to solving the climate disruption problem, synthetic fertilizer. And this is where I will argue, therefore, organic agriculture is a climate smart and friendly system of production, because it does not use synthetic fertilizer. To me, that's almost enough of an argument. Of course, people will argue more. And the other one is enteric fermentation, belches and farts of cows, or whatever. Now, this is a harder one, but I would say I would not be so concerned about it. And here's my reason. Not that CAFOs and some of those issues need to be worked out and fixed. That's for sure. I come from Montana, and we still have bison, lots of bison in Montana. I actually asked somebody at this conference who was talking about ecology about this, and I said, so how many ruminants before, you know, before industrialization were there in the world? And ruminants were always putting methane into the air. So are there more livestock, ruminant livestock, that we manage as humans in the world compared to those that were in the wild, you know, hundreds of years ago? I mean, there's hundreds of millions of buffalo doing enteric fermentation, and it didn't cause a major climate disruption in and of itself. Do you want to comment? You're just thinking. So the point is that we have to be thinking of the issue of what has changed, the net change, and rather than just saying the gross change. And that's a controversial issue because a lot of folks think that we need to change our diet away from meat to solve the climate problem. And I would argue we need to do meat sustainably and well, which means mostly grass-based, and then it'll mean that meat will cost more. We produce a lot of cows in Montana, but they're all shipped to Iowa and Nebraska to be fed out. If we kept that value in Montana and raised them to grass-finished, which many of my friends do, we not only would help with the climate problem, we'd bring more revenue to all our ranchers in Montana. And if I said that in Montana, I'd be in trouble, but go ahead. It's hard. It would really be hard to. Yes, it would probably, because there's the one thing about. Oh, I'm sorry. The question was, do you think it would cost more for sustainably produced meat? Is that a good way to?
Yeah, or I guess maybe
grass-finished meat.
Or particularly localized, relocalized meat production. Would that cost be put on the consumer? I guess I would think it actually wouldn't, because you cut out so many parts of the supply chain that are taking. Parts of I don't like to use the word commodity, but you're transporting it, you're processing it, you're probably putting it to a distributor, then it goes to a grocery. Do you think that that's the case, or do you know any research that kind of actually looks at how sustainable agriculture paired with relocalization impacts cost?
I have looked at that research somewhat, and it's hard to estimate. And we work very hard on trying to do, but you have to think of the number of cows that are produced in Montana exceed our population easily. And there's no way that we're about 1 million people are going to eat all the cows that are produced in Montana. And so therefore, somehow they have to be processed and create value for people, and therefore they have to be moved around. I mean, there's going to always be some movement of products around, and it's always going to have some greenhouse implications. I am not saying that I don't think that greater localization and regionalization of food would help, and I think that's happening slowly, but the basic industry is not configured that way right now, and therefore its climate impact is much greater. But yes, I do believe but I do think it will ultimately probably cost more, because the efficiency of that system is incredible in a technical economic efficiency sense, not necessarily in a humanistic sense, but in a technical efficiency sense. We did the chicken project, and the joke at the end of the project was, can you sell a $25 chicken in Montana? And we actually do sell $25 chickens in Montana, but to very few people, because very few people can afford $25 chickens. I buy $25, I actually raise my own chickens, because I figured it was $25, it cost me about $25. My wife always says, stop doing that. Anyway. I just enjoy it. What?
Well, I just wanted to follow up. I thought you were going to go a little bit farther, because I actually did the calculation that you were talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, at one point, some people have estimated there were 70 to 100 million buffalo on the North American continent in 1830.
Yeah.
And I calculated roughly how many livestock units there are now in North America.
Right.
In terms of cattle, I didn't worry about the elk and the deer and the sheep and so forth. But it's roughly equivalent. It's about the same number of livestock units today. But everybody knows how many internal combustion engines we had in 1830.
Yep.
And today we've got like 400 million or 500 million on the North American continent. And so, you know, and we know that those cause all kinds of greenhouse gases.
Oh, hell yeah.
As well. And let me also say that we're all part of the problem, and I think we should all be try to be part of the solution. And as people in agriculture, we should try to do what we can as well. But a few years ago, there were all these headlines about, well, let's just get rid of cows, and that's going to, you know, solve our problem.
Like that.
and you know, that was a ridiculous conclusion that some people reached and that the news media picked up on.
The
other thing is that part of that United Nations report, I think, that caused all these headlines.
The long shadow of agriculture, yes.
It was, well, it was looking at like cutting down rainforest in Brazil so that you could convert that land to pasture for grazing cows. And a lot of the, you know, cattle grazing and feeding in this world occurs on land that is not being used for producing corn, soybeans, or it's not cutting down forests. It's land that naturally is not forested. There's some grazing and so forth. So
you're speaking of Montana, and large parts of Montana.
Well, much of the Western U.S.
I would have a hard find an alternative use for that land other than grazing ruminant livestock.
Right, right. So,
anyway. I do have to get to insurance, and I do a great talk on that, and I've actually written a publication on that too. So I hear you, and I do want to stress, we are, you know, there was a Pogo, I've met the enemy and it is us. I mean, we all, or if you're evangelical, you know, he was without sin cast the first stone. So we're all, and yes, I am trying to make the point actually that agriculture is not the major contributor to climate disruption, but fossil fuels are. The other thing is carbon sequestration, and that's in this publication. And I know this is way more detailed than you need to look at, but this is from the Natural Academy of Sciences, Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, and some other researchers. And they did a thing where they said, what's the technical possibilities of sequestering through forestry, through other kinds of practices, through agriculture, to sequester carbon and keep it more in the soil to offset greenhouse gases? So here we're talking about offsetting emissions by sequestration. And now there's markets developing around this, and then a whole thing in itself about it. But if you look at, and so this is the technical possibility, not necessarily the actual real possibility of doing these things, but if we kind of just try to extrapolate and say, if we could do this, how would be the impact? And I added up the numbers, and gigatons of carbon dioxide equivalent is a common measurement. I wish I knew in the metric system, but to give you millions of metric tons, gigatons, it's a lot. So we're emitting roughly around 40 gigatons of carbon dioxide equivalent, which is taking all the gases and making to a similar measurement. And about 6.12, they estimate on an annual basis, by doing these kinds of practices, could help offset that emission. So, you know, but this is a technical possibility. This is not what reality is today. This is what we possibly could do. And I want you to look at some of those things. Most of it is avoided forest conversion, reforestation, biochar. Don't get me started on that. I do work on that. Cover cropping. Cover cropping is not all that great in terms of actual sequestration. Trees and croplands. You see that a lot of these things, grazing, legumes and pastures. Sound like all the organic grain farmers in Montana grow legumes. They have to for fertility. That's the source of their pulses are the source of major source of their fertility. So we're already going there. But again, 0.15 gigatons contribution that could come if that was optimally spread around the entire world. Peatland. So we're really not talking about actually so much agricultural practices, actually. So those who preach carbon markets, I'm not so sure that we are barking up a very good tree, because even if they were successful, and don't start me on why I don't think they are, they're not going to make that much of a contribution. And it would take literally hundreds of years to do so. Okay, crop insurance. Some jargon first, just in case, because I tend to start using acronyms and things, and I don't like doing that when people do it to me. Yield risk is what often is referred to as multi-peril. Literally in Hawaii, when a volcano erupts, a cause of loss in Hawaii is volcanic ash, because volcanic ash will come down onto your crops, and they will destroy them, particularly produce and things like that. So that's a cause of loss. It's an insurable cause of loss in Hawaii. It actually was an insurable cause in Montana, but that was when the Mount Olympias went, and it actually caused ash, and they actually filed claims in Montana for volcanic ash that came from the Mount St. Helens eruption. It was bizarre to me because I saw cause of loss in Montana, volcanic, and I know there wasn't any active volcanoes in Montana, and then I dated it, and it was the after effects of Mount St. Helens, which actually caused loss and fires, another source of that ash. So there's lots of causes of loss, but that's yield. That affects your yield. The other is what I call revenue, and revenue is yield times price. Most, as we'll see, most crop insurance is revenue protection because you have two elements of risk. One is what nature, you know, does to you. The other one is what the market does to you. Because when you plan something, you expect a price, but when it's harvest time, the price might be significantly different. You're exposing yourself to a price risk. And that, therefore, I call that a revenue risk. And revenue protection is the single most utilized form of commodity or single product, corn, soybeans, wheat. That's what people use because they cover what? They cover two sources of risk. Now, revenue policies are not available to all farmers everywhere, unfortunately. But there is a way to get around it, but that's where we're going to get to. Approved insurance, or AIP, I might use that term very quickly, is the 13, I think there's actually 14 now, companies that under, I'll get to this, but they basically are the people that service and work with RMA, the risk management. It's a public-private system, and I'll get to that later, but just to get the acronym, agents don't always work for a specific AIP. They often can be independent, work for various other ones. So the agents and the AIPs aren't exactly conterminous. Liability, the value of what is insured. I think people, indemnity is not a common word, but that's basically the value of what the payout. That's what you get. You get an indemnity. You're indemnified, they even say that word. And the premium, of course. We all know what premiums are because we all pay those for any insurance we have. Oops. How the heck did that happen? Oh, I know, I hit this stupid button. There we go, whew, wrong button. So given this is a crop insurance, how can we meet the climate change? A look into the past to consider the future. Okay, now you're gonna have, this is the pragmatic thing. This is a tool that you all could learn to use. I think it's one of the coolest tools that, Who's farming here? That's in the group. What county do you farm in? Do you know? Well, okay. Well, we'll use La Crosse County. Is that okay? That's where we are. This will give you an assessment. What I'm going to show you, and hopefully it'll work, because the technical thing here is going to. I'm going to jump to a tool. It's called the Agris Viewer. I recommend you go play with it, because if you are in a certain county. The unit of analysis in crop insurance is the county. Sometimes you can have a policy available in one county and it won't be available in the next county. That's actually real. But also, you kind of want to know, well, what has been the causes of loss in the county in where I live? This tool will give you that information for about 28 years. It'll give you all the data of all the losses paid out for what causes of losses and how much money was paid out in crop insurance in your county. So if you were a beginning farmer and you were kind of thinking, well, should I buy insurance? Should I not buy insurance? Or if you're just curious about what causes losses, you know, from nature in the place where I live historically, this tool will show you it. And it has a problem. It's not perfect. No tool is perfect. Yeah. Now, the agents work through the AIPs, so the agents can be located. They actually can work in several counties. The companies themselves often hire the agent. It's a kind of a weird, you know, like kind of independent insurance agents, you know, if you ever use it for other things. Some are set up that way. They have their own companies. But they usually have to work through one of the AIPs because those people have a special agreement with the United States. I'll get into that later, but let's look at this tool first. Hopefully this will work because we tried it later. Earlier. Oh, now, of course, it doesn't work. Why? Oh. It worked before. I'm looking at it on my screen. That's the problem. Do you have any idea why this didn't work this time? I just did it before. Do you have an idea? This is so bad, so sad. Yeah.
Is that Risk Viewer on your website?
That's just go AgGIFS Reviewer, Google it, you'll get to it. It's not on our website, no. It's a.
Are you going back and forth between another file and your presentation?
No, I'm not. It was worked before, and that's I knew this might be a problem, but. Oh, good. We got a professional here, and I'm a Luddite when it comes to. Oh, he said, press this. I tried it three times before, and I knew this was going to happen. So I tried to go to the internet. Yeah. Okay. Great.
Now make sure that your pointer is also able to be on.
What pointer are you talking about? This? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can do it here. I'm going to work from here. But
sure.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. I have to anyway because it.
No.
No. What you?
Yeah, it's set up right now, so it's on the screen.
Yeah. But can I see it on my screen?
No.
I had both worked, and it went back and forth. No, it doesn't work. That guy was right here. I am so sorry about this. I know. Okay. Well, how do you know what you're pointing to? Here, I can do it. You don't know the tool that well, so. No, this is not going to work. Shit. Excuse my language. It was so easy before. I can't even get the damn presentation up anymore. Well, I can give you a pretty quick thing here. This is not going to be helpful, but just to give you a sense of it, and then I'll try to get back to my presentation unless the IT people come back. What you can do is, this is counties. I'm not sure even where we're at right now. Okay, La Crosse County, I lucked out. Okay, what this shows you is if you look up there, the dates of this data is from 1989 to 2021. This tells you essentially right now, we're just looking at the total indemnity payments, the total payouts of crop insurance in La Crosse County over that period. And that was $12,269,000 worth of losses during that period for that specific county. And then what you can do is that you have these other ways to look at it. And the one that I find very interesting is called the causes of loss. If I could click on that, it would actually show me what were the major causes of loss in this county during that period. And I did look at it, and it was, I think, drought and then too much water. So, you know, flooding. Flooding and drought were the major causes of loss in this county over that period. Now, if you go, so you can go to any county where your farm is, and you can find this data out, and you can find it. Now, there's a bit of a bias in it, because most crop insurance goes to what? Corn, soybeans, and wheat, which we'll talk about later. So those are overrepresented in the data. So, but at the same time, it's not working. It didn't work. All of a sudden, it just, boom. Anyway, so you can see over time the causes of loss that occur. And so in a way, you can see, and even if it is corn and soybeans and vegetables are all affected by drought. So even if you didn't have insurance, you know that drought is a major problem in this county when there's losses. So this is the cool thing about this tool. It gives you a way to kind of begin to assess what has been the historical sources of risk for agriculture in your county. And it really is fun to play with in that way. And you can get all kinds of, you can look at different specific, you can say, well, what did corn lose? What did, whatever was insured, you can actually look at that specific crop and find out what its causes of loss were too. So you can do this all different kinds of ways. It's a great tool to play around with. Is he helping me or not? Because I need to get back to my presentation too, which I have no idea how to do. Did he do something or no? Is this actually working? Oh, maybe it's working. I don't know. It's not working.
Is that working again?
Cancel. Okay. Yeah, maybe I can pull this down.
Because he said hit the Windows key.
I did hit the Windows key. Oh, P, that's probably what I didn't do. Here, this will give you a sense of this. I'm gonna not do this because it's gonna. So by commodity. So in other words, this is the losses. So most of the losses in La Crosse, this is Lee County now, I believe, yeah, Illinois, but gives you the same idea. So in Lee County over this period of time, corn and soybeans were the crop where the most losses were paid out to, which makes sense because most of the insurance was there. And you can see over time when those payments were made. So you can see what years were bad years and what years were good years in terms of representation through crop insurance. And you can see the dominance of corn and soybeans in the crop insurance program in that county in Illinois, because there's hardly any other crops that even are represented as causes of having losses. Just, it really is one of these kind of things to learn, and I'm old, is you have to play with it. And when you play with it, it's a very cool tool. You can do it anywhere in the country. And now, how do I go back to this? Ah, that was easier. It's all right. What the heck? That's out of order. I shouldn't be going. Where did I stop? There. Okay, big map. This is the current, as of February 6th, it's called an indemnity map. This shows you, again, you can see by county, the darker the color, the more the loss. I look at these every year. I looked at these every year since 2008. And it's interesting to watch because it can show you where the major losses are in the country. And the dark, and you'll see certain areas of the country will stay very high level of losses. The East Texas Panhandle, Oklahoma, the High Line, they call it, in Montana, up there along the Canadian border, a lot of the Dakotas. These are places where you, and then even in the Central Valley of California, with highly valuable specialty crops, and because of California's climate changes and droughts, you can see. And I want you to pay particular attention to the scale on this map, because they did something last year to me that really threw me for a loop. But if you look at that darkest color, that means, if you see that number there, it says $164 million, almost $165 million was paid in some county in the United States in 1 year, paid $165 million in losses. One county. I don't know which of those dark counties it was, but I've watched this over time, and it's interesting to see where most of it always occurs. And in a way, you can sense these. If you wanted to start a farm, don't go to these areas that are dark all the time, because they are the most riskiest places to grow agriculture in the United States. In fact, it's getting to the point where the public cost of it is going to get so high that people may not be able to ranch or farm there unless we're just continually going to pay losses. Now, this is 2021, exactly 1 year earlier. Doesn't it look a lot darker? This is why you should always look at the scale on maps, because the scale changed. Here, they only say where it's dark is over 10 million or more. So, of course, if you have the scale changed, the map looks different. And I knew this was a problem because I looked at these maps every year. When I looked at them, you know, this year, and I said, that's not, can't be right. It was a horrible year in Montana. Well, it's because they changed the scale. And so anyway, the point is, this is a great way to kind of get into the idea of understanding where losses. And it's a public-private system. This is something a lot of people don't realize. Do people know that about anywhere between 60 and 64% of the premiums of farmers' crop insurance is paid by you and I as taxpayer dollars? How many people knew that before they came into this room? Yeah. But not most people do. I go to bars and I say that, and people say, you're lying. Fake news. No, there's data. That's a lot. That's a lot of money. And it's a relationship that's interesting because it's both a public and private thing. We have the private sector kind of servicing the products and getting what they call gains. In some years, you pay out more or take in more than you pay out. That's called a gain. It's an underwriting gain. It's just a fancy name for you take in more than you pay out. And the private, those AIPs, share in that gain. So they, in a sense, have a motivation to not pay out. The less they pay out, the more they get underwriting gains. The business model of crop insurance is very simple. You have very many clients. You renew and renew and renew every time you get resources from that. They have actuaries who can estimate the risk, and they can know to charge a premium such that they're going to at least get back what they paid out. And ideally, if it's a private sector, they want to get more than they pay out, because then they take that money and they invest it. In the private companies, that's what they do. They're not making money on your premium so much as they're making money on the excess premium they gain and invest. My sister works for a life insurance company, a very famous one, and they hire these people that do the investment, and that's the people they pay the most, because the people that can invest that money they gain on people's premiums is how they really make their money. So there's this tendency with the private companies to want to see more come in than goes out, because they share in that, and they share in that risk, but they also gain. And the rate of return on crop insurance has been estimated at about 14%. And I think a 14% rate of return on your investment is not a bad one. And so they have kind of a vested interest in the system the way it is because they gain quite well from it. Ugh. I did that damn button again. Oh, okay. Press the wrong button. And here's a way to see these gains and losses. This is brand new. I just got it yesterday. That's why I had to update my account. So you see the premiums of payouts to farmers are in blue from 2011 to 2021. And then the dotted line is the average payment across those. And then the compensation to the insurance companies is the gold. So you can see very clearly, now 2012 was the most, anybody farming in 2012? It was an incredible, I don't think, well, if we ever repeat that history, that was the biggest set of losses nationwide that ever hit the United States in my lifetime, at least since I've been looking at it. And you can see, so those gains are significant for the companies. They get significant. Sometimes they get paid more than the farmers do. Make sense? You see that? And here's the other thing that people, I think, should know too, is that corn, soybeans, cotton, wheat, pasture is a unique insurance now. But very quickly, this is the average total premiums over those years to these specific crops and who benefits most from the program. Is that surprising to anyone? And a lot of, some of those, like apples, don't have a revenue policy. They're only yield policies, but apples are very valuable. But we're talking like 1% and then all others. And there's an equity issue in crop insurance. The largest 20% of farms receive more than 75% of subsidies, and that on average of these large farms possess between 3.1 million and 15.7 million in total household wealth. This is a great, if you read this public, the National Sustainable Ag Coalition has a very detailed study. A colleague of mine at Montana State University, Eric Belasco, did the work. He's a national expert on crop insurance. And it's showing that essentially the inequity of the program in terms of who benefits most. There's also this argument, there's lots of policies available. Everybody can crop. And I would argue that that's not true. There's lots of farmers that do not have access to crop insurance. Corn is one that a lot of people have crop insurance in corn. Those are all the counties where you can buy a corn policy, revenue policy. You know, in my time in Montana, we didn't used to grow that much corn. But I almost want to say that because of the crop insurance program and how good that insurance is, and probably because of the ability to change the genetics of corn so it can grow in places that it didn't normally grow. I've watched corn kind of invade Montana in my 32 years. And I think part of it is because the insurance is so good that even if you don't do well in corn, you'll get paid pretty well by the insurance. It's from the AGR Light, the Risk Management Agency website. You can actually get all, you know, that's one thing I have to say about the risk management. They're very transparent with their data. I mean, you can find all this information. I didn't have to go through any hard work to do this. They have a map viewer. You can take any crop and you can put this map. You can see which counties and all of that is right there on their website. It's a great website in that sense. Pardon? No, I don't think they have farm size still that I know of. I'm almost certain that's not true. There's also a lot of data they will not make available. I did research, and it's sometimes hard to get. Okay, this is fresh market tomatoes. A big difference in corn, huh? I can't buy a fresh market policy in Montana, but I'm growing fresh market tomatoes, but I don't get any policy for it. And I don't get a revenue policy for it, even if I did. But my point is, yeah, okay. We have insurance for fresh market tomatoes, but if you don't live in those counties, too bad. Except the thing that I've spent last 15 years of my life on is this one, whole farm revenue protection, which I'm going to talk about. To me, this is the answer, and I've tried since 2008 to try to explore that, but when I go to conferences, I get audiences about this size. So you are my disciples. And the disciples, go preach the word, and then the multitudes will learn. Kind of joking, but not really. Anyway, this policy is available in every county in the United States, and it's available to any type of farm size, small to giant. It's the only one of the only policies that does that. And only, unfortunately, about roughly 2,000 policies were sold last year. And I think it's the answer to crop insurance conundrums, but and we'll find out why. So specialty crops, they always say, well, we cover specialty crops. We help specialty crop growers. Look at this. That's the definition. There, in the 2017 census, there were 242,818 specialty crop farms, according to the United States Ag Census. The value estimated by the National Agricultural Statistics Service was 50.7 million acres. In 2017, the same year, the liability, the value, of those was about approximately $2.8 billion. Thus, an estimate of the value of specialty crops not covered by insurance, roughly only 3.2% of that value has been covered by insurance. So how can they say they're servicing specialty crop farmers with crop insurance? They're not. Simply not. But you'll hear in the milieu, you'll hear, well, we've got all these policies for specialty crop farms, and we're adding more every year. Yeah, if you happen to be in the right, you know, there's a policy for, you know what clary sage is? I know what sage is, we have a sage. It's an herb. There's a policy for clary sage in two counties in North Carolina. That's it. Now, I've been interested in finding out, how did they manage to get a policy for clary sage in two or three counties of North Carolina? And I think it has something to do with politics and a lot of other things, but go ahead.
Can you explain how a policy gets to a county or how it doesn't? Like, what's the process of deciding?
That's a really good question. It's a really good question, and I wish it was. I'll give you the short answer, but the complex answer would take me maybe too long. But the easy answer is, if you have enough political pressure and will to put it on the agency to say, we need it for our place. And you go to your senator, your congressman, and you say, we got a really valuable industry here, and they don't provide it. And I'll give you an example. Hemp. Industrial hemp is now insurable. I think they did a terrible job in rolling out that policy because they had no data on which to base an assessment of the actual risk of growing industrial hemp in this country. And I'm going to name names. I'm probably in trouble. But I'll just say it this way. Who is a famous politician from Kentucky? You know. See, he said it. I didn't. Okay. Mitch McConnell and Kentucky think that industrial hemp will save agriculture in Kentucky. Mitch McConnell wanted, and then so he got the law passed so we can grow industrial hemp legally now across, and don't give me the whole story of that, but that was an interesting story in itself. And then the people said, well, we're not gonna do it unless we have insurance for it. So Mitch McConnell said, we will have insurance. And they wrote a policy with no data on which to base this for the entire, well, not all the entire country. You can only buy industrial hemp in certain counties and certain places in the United States. But honest to gosh, to really do a good job to answer your question, you have to have data over time to able to estimate the risk of growing that crop in that particular location to give them the wherewithal to be able to set a premium that's reasonable and will actually cover your thing. And that takes time and effort and money. Now, sometimes bureaucrats are also very go to the tendency of saying, they'll say, well, we don't have enough data, and that's just an excuse that they don't want to do the data with it. So again, it's a combination of political pressure, getting enough data, getting enough information, and you can get a clary sage policy. They did it. A couple counties in North Carolina. I actually know the guy who helped do that because it's a very valuable product and they wanted risk. Insurance. Ah! Stop doing that. Okay, where are we? Which way? Okay, so far, public benefits, crop insurance, to the largest crop farms, single commodity properties dominate, except for whole farm revenue. Whole farm revenue, we'll talk about, and I'll explain why that's so much different. Anyway, questions so far, how are we doing? Ooh, we're 30 minutes, that's okay. I'm gonna go a little faster here. Anybody have any questions so far? I don't wanna be, does it make sense? Is it straightforward? What do you think? Go ahead.
Well, you were talking about the whole farm revenue protection.
Yes.
Everywhere in the country. Do I need to repeat that?
Yes.
You were talking a few moments ago about the whole farm revenue protection offered everywhere in the country, right. And yet it's barely used. And there could be two reasons why it's barely used. One is that very few people know about it because it's et cetera. The other thing is, it's one thing to say it's whole farm revenue protection. It's another thing to know the formulas or exactly how that protection is constructed.
Yeah, I've spent my last, since 2008, I know the formulas, I know how it works, and I know why it's not working. And that's what I'm gonna talk about.
Okay.
I'm only setting this up. I know the answers to the questions. I've been working on it too long. This may be the last time I talk about it in my life, but anyway, I'm gonna shift to a different thing that's an issue that is related to climate, and this has caused a lot of problems for farmers in Montana, particularly organic farmers. This is the definition. You know, when you say a good farming practice, would you like to be the person in a federal bureaucracy to say, this is a good farming practice, and that is not a good farming practice? Would you want to be the person to say that? I wouldn't want to be the person to say that. And maybe there are experts that would say this is a good farming practice and that's a bad farming practice. And so what Risk Management Agency does is they don't actually say what is a good farming practice or what is not a good farming practice, but they nonetheless have a definition of what a good farming practice is. And this is it, verbatim. And I put a red part because this has caused so much problem with organic farmers and innovation in agriculture. Allow it to make normal progress toward maturity and produce at least the yield used to determine the production guarantee amount of the insurance. If I adopted cover crops and I hadn't done cover crops, do you think my yield would be impacted? There, by four, by this definition, cover cropping is not a good farming practice because my yield, my historical yield, will be different because I adopted that practice. That, like 5 years ago, caused a conundrum because the natural resource conservation is pushing what? Cover cropping. Everybody's pushing, do cover cropping, do cover cropping, do cover cropping. And the farmer said, well, if I do cover cropping, I could invalidate my crop insurance. I'm not gonna go there. I got a great policy. Why should I change the way I farm and lose that advantage if I'm gonna be dinged for doing cover crops? Did you know that was existing? So in Montana, they interseeding. They put legumes in between the crops. That's verboten. That's not a good farming practice because no one does it, and they did it. And of course, if they had insurance before and they adopted it and they told their insurance agent, they could jeopardize their crop insurance. What do? They do it anyway and don't tell their crop insurance agents, meaning they're in jeopardy. But it's the only way they have to do it. That's the way they need to farm, the great fertility in Montana. So they do it despite this definition. But I can't stand the fact that those people could lose their farm, literally, by getting caught interseeding when it's a very, practice that's been not ideal, but one that they have adopted and need to use. And here's just more of the same. Provide, again, they say, oh, NRCS will generally recognize, and experts all say that. But then they say, provided the adoption of SUP does not negatively impact the insurers to make a normal progress towards a maturity. Well, what practice would not make necessarily upset your normal maturity of your crop until you learn how to do it anyway? This is probably one of the fundamental reasons why crop insurance is hampering innovation in agriculture and hampering organic farmers who do some of the most interesting and out there ways of trying to make their farms more resilient. So is cover cropping a good farming practice? Is interseeding a good? Is organic farming a good farming practice as a system of production? I mean, if I shift from organic, from non-organic to organic, you don't think my yields are going to change? Of course they're going to change for oil. I would argue that over time, I've watched them, they get really good at yields after time, over time. But they jeopardize, so not only is it hard to transition because you have to go 3 years not getting the premium for the, you know, you have to deal with this. So it's inhibiting the transition to organic agriculture by itself because of course it's going to impact. Okay. And then I was going to do this Agris viewer, but we won't do that again. And now we're going to go to this. An essential question is the ability of farmers and ranchers to adopt climate-friendly practices or systems of production constrained by economic factors, including federal crop insurance subsidies, and the financial risk of implementing different crop practices and systems of production. I didn't write that. This guy named Bitterman did. It's his master's or PhD thesis. But this is the essential question. And I think the essential question that the, why crop insurance is inhibiting the development of organic farming in this country. And for that matter, with non-organic, the innovations that are required to build resilient systems of production to address climate. And there's research on it. And I'm just tapping into some of it. Most research on, first of all, most of the research is done with corn and soybeans, so that doesn't help with a lot of other crops you would like to look at. Crop-specific significantly affect crop diversification. Farmers respond to the incentive of lower growing costs. Specializing farms may be able to capture product-specific economies, but in the process may also reduce their ability to manage risk or get, you know, economies of scope. Crop insurance likely changes land use. Blah, blah, blah. I did find that 70% of these folks, the farmers, agree that climate change is occurring, but they also confirm that federally subsidized crop insurance as the primary source of a farmer being able to cope with it. This is just some of the research on this issue. But I think it's a fundamental one that is inhibiting progress and change and the ability of, to be resilient to act, to the, what's coming down the road. So whole farm revenue is completely different. And I am running out of time. It used to be called adjusted gross revenue. That's not so important. It now, as of this year, it shares up to $70 million in revenue. With only 2,000 policies, there's no one, I've looked at all the data, there's no one that has $70 million in historic revenue using this policy, but you could. It's based on your 5 years of your historic revenue. Essentially, whole farm says it's completely different. It's grow any combination of products you would like at any scale and any type. We'll look at your history, historical capacity of that farm to generate a revenue based on your tax records with some adjustments. And that gets where it gets hairy. But anyway, and let's say historically you had a gross revenue of 100,000. They'll say, you can, the highest rate of coverage is 85%. We'll cover 85% at 100,000. If in the year of your insurance, you drop below 100,000, below 85,000, we pay up to 85,000. So the choice of what you grow is yours. How you grow it is yours. All we want to know is, can you generate a revenue? And we have good data to show it. If you're a beginning farmer, you only have to have three. That lets you in a little earlier. And we'll give you some insurance to protect that revenue. all of those problems about interseeding, all about, although you have to follow good farming practices with whole farm revenue. I don't know how they're going to catch you at it, but because it's only based on your revenue. It's not, it doesn't, they don't care what you grow. They don't care what size you are. They don't care if you're a little tiny veggie operation. We'll get to that too. This is an important, historically, until this year, this just changed, and it's a lot of work by a lot of people that got this changed. You used to have to not only document your historical revenue, you had to document your historical expenses. And if you didn't meet some percentage of 70% of your historical expenses, you were dinged on your insurance. No other insurance policy in the federal crop insurance program did that. We argued for 8 years to take that out. Last year, we finally won, and it's not there anymore. That is, you talked about why aren't people using it. The paperwork of tracking expenses for 5 years is ridiculous, and that just blew farmers away. They said, I'm not going there. I'm doing that. It was hard enough to get them to bring in their tax records to set it up, and then they do this, and they say, this is getting crazy. The agent said, this is getting crazy. We can't do it. Now we cut it, that paperwork, about in half, two-thirds even, because that's no more required. So it's getting better, and it's taken a long time to get it better, and maybe it'll get used more because of it. I was trying to answer your question there. And this is the other thing that is unique and why the Secretary of Agriculture in a report on climate has said and only named this policy as the only policy in federal crop insurance that is climate smart and friendly. Why? Because the more different products you grow, the lower your premium. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Your risk is minimized. Therefore, it incentivizes diversity. No other policy does that. It incentivizes diverse systems of production. So we went back to the Secretary of Agriculture, but you only sell 2,000 policies in the United States. How much of an impact is it going to make on climate, this great policy that incentivizes diversity? And so that's why they, in part, started to fix it. He shouldn't have that button there. Now there's a new micro program for those that are in vegetable production. It's even easier. It's very simple. It reduced paperwork, but it's only good for people that have historic 350,000 or less. So it's very small, highly diversified farms. You don't have to normally do it in your expected year. You have to show all the different crops you grow, what your expected revenue is from each and every crop. If you have 50 crops, that's a really painful process to go through to estimate what your expected revenue is in the year of insurance. So no one used it, especially the small guys, because I ain't going to go through all that work. And so what they do now is you just have one line, what your gross revenue was from whatever crops they were. And that's how they determine your expected revenue. So in other words, you just say, I had this revenue, and this is going to be my expected revenue in the future, and you move forward. It's much easier now. It's just been rolled out this year. We'll see how many people use it and how many people become aware of how much easier and useful it has become for smaller, highly diversified people, I'm hoping. And this gives you a sense of diversity. The diversity thing is a bit tricky, and I don't think it's significant, but I just did this little thing where you basically add one crop, and then you show the producer's premium cost, and you can see that as you add crops. So by the time you get down to there, you get a 16% reduction in your premium. So I think, well, there's big arguments about this, but I think that there needs to be a greater incentive for diversity, and it needs to even be lower, because it depends on the crops that you're adding and your location. So sometimes the diversity indicator, you know, helps you a lot. I've done these in different places in the country with different groups, and sometimes it helps you more than others, because certain crops are riskier than others. So that's embedded into the program. If you add or subtract different crops, the diversity indicator changes somewhat. But it does at least give you the benefit and incentivizes diversity. And it covers, like I say, all these millions of crops. And apples are dominant. It's a kind of an irony that a program that was set up to incentivize diversity is now used by most of the apple growers in the United States. We're kind of monoculture people. And you know why? It took me years to figure this out. But partly it's because there's no other revenue policy for apples in the country. And revenue, the volatility of fruit prices is quite great. So a cause of loss from decline in price is significant in the apple industry. And when they realized they could cover that risk of loss from price change for their apples, they bought it up like crazy. And the person that's the AIP that made a whole lot of business and booked a lot of business on that product, that one apple thing alone. But it, all kinds of crops are being utilized. I don't have time to do the RMA cost estimator, but I can show anyone. On the website of RMA, there is a good cost estimator. You can actually estimate the cost of all insurances and whole farm, including the micro, with this tool. It's a bit complicated. It is not user-friendly. I wish it was. My wife and I built a tool once to make it user-friendly, but it never got enough funding to keep it going, so we don't have it anymore. We used to provide it for farmers. And it made it easier, again, the constraint of paperwork, to figure out ahead of time before they went to the agent and make it easier for their agent to write the policy up. And that is one of the significant problems, is both that it's difficult, but also that no one understands it and doesn't know it, so they're afraid. So when you go to your typical agent and you ask for whole farm revenue, they'll say, oh, you don't want to go there. Oh, that's really, you know, they don't want to do it because they don't want to work that hard and they can sell more policies other ways. The requirements for paper can be onerous. Often they will ask for more than your tax records, and if they do, let them give you an answer because the government made me. That's not why they're asking. They have the ability, they have the choice to ask for more paper to verify your tax records, but you have the right to say, why do you need that? This is all you are supposed to need. And if they say, the government makes me do it, that's not true. The government does not make them do it. It gives them the option of doing it. So, and if you go in and get an estimate for a whole farm revenue policy and somebody gives you that answer, call me. Because I want to know what kind of answers agents and people are giving to the question when they ask for more records, because the records is the biggest thing that's inhibiting people from using it. And it should only be your tax records that's necessary, period. Yes. You have to have a farm number. Yeah. Everyone that uses any federal program has to have a farm number. So crop insurance is highly subsidized. Systems change to greater crop and livestock diversity seems essential, but our policies don't do it. The system does not do it now, except for whole farm. To go crop insurance like revenue for crops pushes farmers to acquire additional margin land, which implicates also for climate. And RMA, good farming practice, has to change. It simply has to change, or we have no innovation. We were stuck in a treadmill of having, their banker requires insurance if they're gonna get an operating loan. And so they get revenue policy. They don't even think about it anymore. That's why people don't come to these things. They don't think about insurance anymore. They just have to do it. If you're a corn soybean vendor, you have to do it. Very few don't, you know, have the ability. Some are really wealthy and they don't have to, they can self-insure. But most people don't, and they don't even think this is an alternative. It's not equitably distributed. Whole farm provides for greater diversity. And it may be particularly advantageous to organic farmers. Because remember, if your historic value of your historic revenue is based on the premium and the value that you got for organic, it's embedded in the system. So you will pay more for insurance, but you're also insuring something of higher value that is recognized. That is not true for revenue policies for individual crops, that they are giving you the full actual value of the crop that you need to insure as an organic farmer, which is higher. This does because it's automatically embedded in your history. So my personal vision, and we're almost done. We have 10 minutes for questions. A reformed whole farm revenue becomes the dominant form of, this is my dream, and it will probably be a dream. I probably will die not seeing it happen. But I spent since 2008 trying to get it this far. I'm about ready to retire. Somebody else better pick up this torch and move forward, and someday we might get there. And we need to figure out ways to incentivize the kinds of systems that are going to be resilient to agriculture, and crop insurance is probably one of the single greatest barriers to it. These are some resources, and these are who I work for now. These are my two grandchildren, Maya, and she is magical, and she is an illusion, and Alma, who is the soul. The future is theirs, and all I can do is do my best to make a good one for them. And that's me, and I love to talk about crop insurance, and we can work you through all of these things. Any other questions? Who's going to go try to get an estimate for whole farm revenue production? Do it. Just do it for fun. They have to do it. Make them write a quote up for you.
I have a climate question. I'm just curious. So there's an Australian study and maybe others that 80% of the methane emissions from ruminants can be eliminated by feeding a quarter pound of kelp a day.
Yeah.
Have you heard that?
I don't know. I mean, I kind of think, like I said, I think it's a wash. It doesn't really, the enteric fermentation to me is not an issue in climate. What's more of an issue is how we produce ruminants. And that's more of the issue. It's not the
cattle
climate.
The cattle in the feedlots are emitting methane just the same as one on.
Yeah, well, that system has to change. And then we'll really affect climate.
Also,
Yes. Yeah, do we have enough kelp? The other one I've heard. And also activated or biochar activated carbon. They think I have a farmer ranchers that do that in Montana, and they claim it helps for a lot of reasons. Go ahead.
I was wondering if you knew of any examples of like technical assistance programs around crop insurance from like a university perspective. Are there people who are, you know, putting together programs?
ATRA, me, us, we are there for technical assistance. Your taxpayer dollars paid for me to be here.
Right.
So you're getting some taxpayer dollar money back right now. Feel happy.
Right. So like, I guess, or maybe you could explain a little bit more, because I'm an extension agent in California. That's why I'm in California. And I was wondering if you could like provide a little bit of like thoughts on like the approach, or kind of like how do you get information out? How do you work with farmers around like figuring out what would work for them?
Well, as you can see from the attendance of my conference, mm-hmm. crop insurance is not I tried to mix it with climate because I thought that would be more attractive to people. And I got more. I've come to this conference many, many years. Yeah. And I used to have to sit out there and try to hook people in, and I get two or three. So this is actually a relatively big crowd for crop insurance, mm-hmm. But I kind of goes back to that when I was making that statement. First of all, the highly diversified people have been not supported by crop insurance for so long. Right. When they hear somebody come and say, now we have this great slick thing to help you, they go away. I've mitigated risks in so many other ways because I am diverse. I don't need your crop insurance, and I don't want and it's the federal government and all that stuff, but whatever, you know. Right. So they don't even want to listen to you. Even though I think they should at least explore it, you know? So the way I would approach it is giving them an actual, I do this all the time, and you can hire me to do this, not hire me, you can do it for, I can do it for you to free because that's what I get paid for. And you can give a really good case studies. I did one in Ohio last week at the Ohio Ecological Farming Convention. An actual farmer gave me their data. I actually ran an estimate of their costs. I showed them how their highly diversified farms could be insured, what their revenue guarantee would be. And you know, and I said, so now you're going to buy it? And they go, no.
Yeah.
And they were almost the perfect example for wanting to buy it. But I think it goes back to it's a cost. And the costs are important, mm-hmm. and they have to judge that against risk, mm-hmm. and they have worked so long without it, and maybe it's better. I mean, I'm to the point where maybe we should just be increasing, you know, we should throw the whole damn thing out and for everyone, because that's equity, but and then everybody let it go and see what happens. So I have a lot of our, the guy that's going to speak, your keynote speaker, has told me, he says, I would love them to take all crop insurance away from everyone, and I bet I beat them. Because I have the best resilience system that you can possibly devise, and my risk is already mitigated so well that I don't absolutely. But then also, if he hadn't crop insurance, he'd be broke. So it's this dependency that we have.
Right.
But I do think this is a better way to go, and this will make, if it could work, it would open up for so many more farmers to have some degree of security for the losses. You know, when the polar vortex came down 2 or 3 years ago in Texas, there were two policies that were whole farm revenue in the state of Texas. Mm. If every farmer of that caliber and diversity had had whole farm revenue, we wouldn't have had to make millions and billions of dollars in disaster payments because they would have a crop insurance that would have paid and covered their assets so they could keep farming.
That's really my question. Is in California, there's like increase. I mean, we have so many reactive like opportunities for financial support, which is great. And there's a question increasingly in like extension spaces and in public institution spaces around like, how do we actually get people in situations where like they're not scrambling to try to get like wildfire, drought, you name it, like all the different things. Like it's traumatizing to go through those things. And like, how do you get people in a position where they can be more resilient and like proactive too?
Yeah, and at the same time that we're spending billions of dollars on crop insurance subsidization, we're spending billions of dollars on disaster assistance. How is it going to end? Where is it going to end? I have no idea, but all I know is it's going up. The cost of insurance has to go up, crop insurance, because the risk is going up. And you believe me, the actuaries know this. And they were working, they're running God knows how many different models to try to figure it out so that they can keep making money at insurance. That's their business.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, everyone. It's a pleasure. And feel free to contact me anytime.